It's good to be with you this evening. I guess it's been a while since I've been here because at least two people said, have you ever been here before? And yes, I have. Summer Bible school evening. Brother John asked me to share an evening, and I found the file this week of what I talked about, but I didn't have time to open it to find out what I said before. This topic, Caleb, when he said there's stories the younger generation needs to know. And so that's kind of what I want to do tonight. I want to look first at Joshua 4. Joshua 4. When the children of Israel crossed the Jordan River, 12 men were instructed to take stones from the river. As I've read through it, I think maybe there were two piles of stones, but I'm not going to get into that. One in the river and one on the other side of the river at Jericho. And they were to be memorial stones. Memorial stones. Joshua 4, verse 5. And Joshua said, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan. And each one of you take a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of children of Israel, that it may be a sign among you that when your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? You shall answer them and say, the waters of Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel forever. And then at the end of the chapter, he says basically the same thing about the pile of stones that were there outside of Jericho, the 12 stones. And if your children say, what do these stones mean? You will say, Israel crossed over this Jordan River, for the Lord your God dried up all the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea when he dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the people of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord, that he is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever, that others may know and that you may know. And so what mean these stones? Now, we as Mennonite people don't have a whole lot of memorial stones around. There are ruins of old buildings, there are cemeteries, there are a few monuments. Mostly stories, some of them vague, some of them passed down, that we hardly even know whether they're true or not, but usually oral family stories do carry some weight. And I want to start here in this community. And why is the center of the Mennonite community in Virginia, in Rockingham County and Augusta County, and not at Strasbourg? Because when the Mennonites came to Virginia, in Luray, in Woodstock, and in Strasbourg is where they first settled. Strasbourg, I think, was once called Stauferstadt. And while the Staufer who started Strasbourg probably was not a Mennonite, there were many Mennonites who settled here because when they came to America, Pennsylvania was full, they headed west, the Indians stopped them there, so they just kind of made the turn and came down the Shenandoah Valley, and they liked it because it was a lot like Switzerland. A lot of things reminded them of Switzerland, so they settled in this area. And so why is the big Mennonite community not here? Even though they settled here first in the 1700s, to be successful, there are about three L's, and then I'll add an extra one. You have to have strong leadership. You have to have a love for the Mennonite faith. And you have to have loyalty to the church. And a fourth one the historians don't put down, but you have to have enough marriage partners for the young people. They didn't have Bible schools and mission trips and things to run into other people in those days. And so, they didn't have enough young people. And so they married in their neighbors, and the churches died out. Strong leadership, love for the Mennonite faith, loyalty to the church. And so the 1700s, Pennsylvania was full. People moved west and south. They liked the land here, but they were not self-contained settlements. They were spread out. Some moved into the Winchester area and came down to Strasbourg, to Woodstock. Some were across at Luray and coming across the mountains by horseback, probably wasn't that far in those days. Services were held in homes. There were ministers and quite possibly one bishop. They didn't keep very good records in those days. And there was one man who was in the historical stories is called a minister and an elder. And whether the Strasbourg community had a bishop back in the 1700s, quite possibly. But what happened? Why the decline? They had about 25 prosperous years, and then a number of things happened that brought the settlements here to an end. Leadership was somewhat limited. The wilderness needed to be tamed. And for better or worse, I think it seems to be in the story of Mennonite history during the 1700s, they were so busy getting their farms and mills and houses built that spiritual life lagged. George Fox told his Quaker people when they came to America, he said, guard the plantation of your souls while you are working on your plantations, building your farms, and so forth. Guard the plantation of your souls. And I'm wondering if the Mennonite people in the 1700s in this area did not guard the plantations of their souls. And a good lesson for us to keep in the midst of our busyness, our jobs, and so forth, guard the plantation of our souls. That's George Fox. That's not Mennonite. But it gathers truth. So some of the reason the young people, they were scattered. The young people married into other churches. The King of England freely gave away land to different people, and he didn't bother checking where the boundaries were. And some of the early Mennonites suddenly found themselves owing money to this person, and they just kind of gave up and said, we want clear titles to our land, and so they moved away. So land problems were something. Struggle over deeds and so forth. There was also Indian problems. The reason the Shenandoah Valley was settled by Scots, Irish, Germans, English, Quakers, and so forth is because the planters east of the mountains said, yes, you may move here. And basically they didn't say, we need a buffer between you and the Native Americans. And so this was the Wild West. This was the Wild West. And as the French and Indian War came, there were Indian troubles. In 1758, there were about, across the mountain, there were about 50 people killed. Several hundred families fled as refugees, including some 39 Mennonite families who did lose some family members in Indian raids at that point. They made an interesting appeal to Holland for money and for help. Now, we have this stereotype that the Swiss Mennonites and German Mennonites stayed faithful to God, and the Dutch Mennonites became wealthy and worldly. Maybe so, but they were always very generous. The Swiss and German Mennonites needed help. They appealed to the Dutch. The Dutch kept giving them money to help them move to America. And when they got to America, these Virginians who became refugees, they sent two of their leaders to Holland, and the Dutch shelled out money and then also paid the way of the ministers who came and sent them back. And so helped out the need of the Mennonites, in particularly in Page County. So I just want to put a plug in for the Dutch Mennonites. It wasn't all wealthy and worldly. And so they came back. They came back, and in 1765, you have the Rhodes Massacre. Hans Rotten, who was a Mennonite preacher over near Luray, he, the parents and six children were killed. His house was burned. The people quickly buried their bodies in the sand along the Shenandoah River. And but he had a number of children that survived, and down along the Shenandoah River, there's a monument where they were quickly buried in the soft river sand. And then 100 years ago, family members put a nice big monument talking about John Rhodes. And now it's on private property. And you can't get into it unless you have the right connections. And I don't have the right connections. But before it was private property, I wandered through the house that his son rebuilt. It was very much like German houses. And I was able to see the monument that was there. Probably not connected with the Rhodes' family and in our churches today. More other families are connected to that Rhodes massacre story. But apparently no resistance to Native Americans, simply suffering, being in the place where there was warfare and suffering and dying. But the big thing that destroyed the church was revivalism. In the Great Awakenings, there were new lights and old lights. Almost every church had them. The people who had the new light, the people who held to the old ways and were the old lights. Mennonites experienced it, Baptists experienced it, Presbyterians experienced it. It was called the Great Awakening, and in the Mennonites, particularly over in in Page County, there was unrest during the Great Awakening with revivals. Were we saved? Were we not saved? A Mennonite preacher from Lancaster County came down, who was kind of a New Light Mennonite, and helped them to find, some of the people find security in their faith, but it didn't stop there, because also Baptist revivalists came in and began leading the Mennonite people into their fellowship. The Mennonite people had some misgivings, and they said, well, yes, you have a good, sound teaching on the new birth, but what about swearing of oaths? Jesus said we're not supposed to, and you Baptists allow it. What about loving your enemies and not going to war? You Baptists allow that. What about slavery? Guess what the Baptists said? These are non-essentials. Kind of, you know, the old fiddle, the story just keeps getting repeated through the years. And they said, no, it's non-essentials. You've got to get saved, and you are just spiritually dead, and you need to get wakened up, and you need to become new light. And a large group of the Mennonite community came into the Baptists, but they always had this misgiving, particularly when the Revolutionary War came. They said, well, we just don't fit in with these Baptists because we don't believe in serving in the military. And the Baptists said, oh, you just have nursery faith. I think that's the phrase they use. You just have a nursery faith. You don't have a staunch faith. If you had a staunch faith, you wouldn't be worried about all these things. And so there was kind of a love-hate relationship between the Baptists and the Mennonite Baptists. Eventually, the Mennonite Baptists died out, moving away. And what is left in Page County, cemeteries, the old Hamburg Meeting House, which Mennonites may have used or may not have. I'm not going to argue about it. All the only thing I argue about is why do they have that singing in the sweltering first Saturday in August or Sunday in August instead of waiting till October when it's cool and you can enjoy it. But anyhow, but whether that was a Mennonite meeting house or not, that's beside the point. But we do have stones and stories from that community. Oh, incidentally, going over the mountain, across the Shenandoah River, heading toward Luray, if you look down in the left, the big white building out in the field, that's where the Mennonite Baptists worshipped. It's been enlarged, second story put on, but that was the old meeting house that the Mennonite Baptists used there in that county. And so the story basically, a few people lingered on through the years, but basically the community died out on this side. And when people came back after being refugees or they moved down to Rockingham and Augusta County. And so instead of this being the center of Mennonite world here in Virginia, which it could have been, you all are starting over. And God bless you in that. Hang on to the faith and learn from their mistakes. It's part of our legacy. It's part of our... Another story that I would like to tell is the story of Samuel Kaufman. Now that story starts in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, because a Kaufman family, history says that the wife thought they should move. They moved from Shenandoah back to Greenbrier, West Virginia. The Kaufmans and the Wengers. The Kaufmans and the Wengers moved back there. They apparently were related, and so you see a problem coming in the next generation. Who were they going to marry? And one of the young people that was there in the next second generation or so was a young man by the name of Samuel Kaufman. Samuel Kaufman returned to Rockingham County. He was baptized. He got married. And in a few years, he was ordained to the ministry. But he always kept his connection with his family in Greenbrier County. The congregation was weak there, eventually died out. One old lady into her 90s remained, considered herself a member of the Mennonite Church. And Samuel Kaufman, from time to time, would go back to Greenbrier to preach. He was one of the first of the Mennonites who went across the mountains and preached in West Virginia. Preaching in West Virginia started before the Civil War. Churches were established, maybe more house churches, but there were baptisms, there were fellowships, there was communion, and then Samuel would head down to Greenbrier, riding his horse down through the mountains. Apparently, he went often enough that the children along the way learned to know him, and they would call him Grandfather Kaufman when he rode by. A reminder, you know, pay attention to the children and be friendly. And they loved to see him when he came. He would go down to Greenbrier. He would preach, but the church basically died out. Nothing is left there but a cemetery. It lingered on. Most of his cousins... They could have had good leadership because many of his cousins became ministers in the Methodist Church and other churches, but when the Civil War came, they chose to go into the Confederate military system. That part of West Virginia was pro-Confederate. But he kept, through the years, he kept contact with a community that was also dying. And I guess I'll throw this in for Jennifer. Who in literature?
Pearl Buck.
Pearl Buck, yes, was a descendant of the people in that community. I forget her maiden name, Steinecker or something like that. But Pearl Buck, and whether she knew her Mennonite connection or not, but I thought I'd throw that in for the literature lady here. Okay. Those of you when you're CLE writing, I think your story is The Frill. And if you read that, she came from that community. Well, that's a rabbit trail, and that's historians are good at rabbit trails, so I'll try not to do that too often. Samuel struggled. Is my ministry effective or not? Here he was, traveling in the mountains, preaching in the Shenandoah Valley, and struggling, was my ministry effective? And Martin Burkholder, who was his bishop, said, well, maybe someday you'll get my office and you'll find out that what you're facing now is pretty easy. I told that at a minister's study week one time, and I noticed a good number of heads nodding from older church brothers who said, you know, yeah, get ordained as a bishop and you'll understand that your responsibility isn't quite as much as you think it is. But for Samuel Kaufman, it was a major thing because right before the Civil War, Martin Burkholder, the bishop, died. And right at the beginning of the Civil War, Samuel Coffin was ordained as bishop, a young inexperienced bishop facing the Civil War, facing uncharted territory. Uncharted territory. What do we do? What do we do? And we can sit here many years later and say, this is what they should have done, but the story is a little bit murky sometimes. Part of their response to the Civil War was, it hit them so suddenly. Samuel Coffin was preaching at the Weavers Church one Sunday morning in June. He heard horses outside. Two men in military garb came in. One of them marched down and sat on the front bench. I think that would be kind of disconcerting if you were trying to preach. And he sat and he had he kept on preaching. At the end, he called for the closing song. At that point, the military man stood up and said, all men between 18 and 45 will report for military duty immediately. And the church had no time to sit down and have study conferences or this kind of thing. This was when you made your decision. And so some of the beginning part of the war, some did this and some did that. Many agreed to report to Stonewall Jackson's Virginia militia, but stopped by Samuel Coffin's place and said, we will not shoot. And so they didn't. And the story of Christian Good, who should not have been drafted because he was taking care of his widowed mother, was put on the front lines, and I'm not sure where, on the front lines, and his captain said, apparently noticed something, said, why didn't you shoot? And Christian Good said, I didn't see anything to shoot at. And the captain said, well, don't you see those Yankees over there? He said, yes, but they're men and I don't shoot men. And he was there for, and this became known, Stonewall Jackson, who was the head of the Virginia militia, realized that he had a large number of young men in his army who would not shoot, who did not see anything to shoot at. And Stonewall Jackson, to his credit, tried to put them in different situations than in military situations. They could have been court-martialed and shot, but they were not. Stonewall Jackson was very religious, and the Civil War was a very religious war. Lots of revivals and so forth, prayer meetings. Stonewall Jackson did not like the Yankees because they fought on Sunday. And that wasn't fair, I guess. You were supposed to take Sunday off as a day when you don't fight, and the Yankees fought on Sunday. For many years down at Weir's Cave, there was an oak tree. It has blown down, but it was called Stonewall Jackson's Prayer Oak, where he would have prayer meetings. But to give Stonewall Jackson a credit, he did respect the conscience of those who would not shoot. The young men would gather around the campfire, Mennonites and brethren young men. They were called dunkers back then, so I'll use the term dunker. The Church of the Brethren today would gather around the campfires and sing, and the other soldiers would listen to them. One of the songs that they sang was, Am I a Soldier of the Cross? And I suspect that there was a different understanding of Am I a Soldier of the Cross from his Methodists and who were listening, and the Mennonite and Brethren young men, because they were committed to wanting to follow Jesus. And so the deserting began. The deserting began. So basically there were three routes that young people took, young men took, and older men, because of up to 45. There were a few who did serve willingly, and they lost their church membership. There were some who were not church members yet, and the question that they struggled with is, you know, do we accept the values of our church culture and not go into the army, or what do we do? It appears that in Augusta County, the young men were more prone to go into the Confederate Army than in Rockingham County under Brother Kaufman's leadership. Some served under compulsion. Right beside Pipe Church was the Michael Shank farm, and he refused to go. So the Confederate soldiers came, loaded him up in a wagon, and drove him to prison in Winchester. I believe there is connection in this congregation with Michael Shank through his daughter Katie Lehman. And some of you, see, you need to know these stories for your children, because it goes back, the Lehmans go back to Katie Shank Lehman. She was the little premature that Catherine wrote about in Lifelines, number back. Yeah, she was a little premature. She weighed a pound and a half and survived. Okay, I won't go into that. But tough stuff, those Lehmans. Okay, let's see. Another would be the story of Philip Parrott. And I think the Campbells have connection with Philip Parrott. Philip Parrott, mother was Mennonite, father was Presbyterian, joined the Confederate Army, deserted, went back to the Army, deserted again, and when he came home the second time, he asked to be baptized into the Mennonite Church. He was baptized, accepted the non-resistant faith, and headed for Franklin County, Pennsylvania, where he, I guess, lived the rest of his life. Poor fella. They spoke German up there. He didn't know any German. It was kind of like a duck out of water. He missed the English preaching at home, and he finally got his English preaching because he was ordained minister. Some people thought he was probably a little bit worldly because he couldn't preach German, but he hung in there. And but the Philip Parrott story is one who had to make the decision between his mother's church and his father's church, and he chose his mother's Mennonite faith. Other went into hiding. Some of you know the story of Potter John Heatwell, who was in the army, out of the army, was told to go back to the army, so he went into hiding and built places in the mountains west of Harrisonburg. If you want a really good hike, I used to run and play soccer with you. But the last time I took the hike, I was laid up for about 2 days. It's tough. But back in the mountains above Union Springs, there is a chimney. Apparently it was Potter John's little cabin in the mountains, a little spring beside it where he got his water and where he hid. There may have been many places where he hid, coming down in the valley, then going back into the mountains. One time he came back to his little place, and it was dark. And there was something in there, in his little cabin that he built. And here it was, a rattlesnake. But it didn't bite him because it was trying to eat a rat. And his mouth was full of rat. And so the Lord protected him. Other times, one time he came back to his house and his books were there, but some other things were stolen. So he figured apparently it was kind of low class because they weren't interested in his books. But he'd moved from place to place. And the story that gets passed down is soldiers came to arrest him. It had snowed. And so he walked up over the mountain backwards. And so when the soldiers came to his house, to his little hut, he wasn't there. And one of them said he must have ascended. And it was hard enough walking down to his place frontwards without walking up over the mountain backwards, is all I'll say. But if you need to know where it is, Dale and Doris Heatwell pinned it on their cell phone. So if you want to go for a good family hike sometime, which is rather strenuous, check with them, because they can show you exactly where to find that little chimney that remains of his place. But one thing he did when he went back over the mountains into West Virginia, he took his Bible and his confession of faith along and shared his faith with those in West Virginia. I don't think the Mennonite preachers had gotten that far into West Virginia, but when he came back after the Civil War, he said to the ministers, "We need to be sharing the gospel there in that part of West Virginia. People are open to the gospel." And perhaps, I don't know if we can consider it direct or not, but the legacy of our churches in West Virginia, at least North Fork, that area, in part goes back to Potter John's going into West Virginia as a refugee and sharing the gospel as he went. Talking about hiding and going, an underground railroad developed in the Shenandoah Valley for Mennonites, for Dunkers, for Confederates who were tired of the whole thing, perhaps a few blacks, but not very many. And they had an elaborate system where they would take people over the mountains so that they could go up to Kaiser, West Virginia, catch the train, and then go north or west to escape conscription. Because part of the problem was if you were young and got older, you didn't have any exemptions. I'll get into the exemptions. But so if you were too young to get an exemption, then you had to leave. How did they leave this underground railroad? At one point, there were 70 men decided that they were going to escape to the north. They got to Petersburg, West Virginia. The water must have been higher in those days than it is today because they had to use horses to go across the river. They got across the river, these 70, and there were two Confederate scouts that stopped them and arrested them. 70 versus 2. Yeah. What goes through your mind? Why didn't they jump them? No. They were committed to non-resistance. They were told to turn over their weapons. Some of them turned over their Bibles. And interesting, a Dunker report of this said there were two pistols, but the Mennonites had them. Okay, so I could tell you where there's a few Mennonite pistols today, but I won't. Okay, but and so they marched them into Petersburg. They marched these 70 down to Franklin. They marched them from Franklin to Monterey. They marched them across the mountains from Monterey to Stanton. I see Pat back there. Wow. Yeah, it was a long walk. They were tired. But they had agreed together that we will not escape because we want to stick together so that we can encourage one another. And so sometimes their guards just kind of left them on their own. And, you know, they basically said, we want you to show up in Stanton. They did. They showed up in Stanton. They were taken by train to Richmond, where they were put in prison. You can go down along the canal, along the James River, and there's signs there where these old prisons were that our people were kept. These 70 were there. It was not the best conditions, but they weren't the worst. And the Confederate Congress was meeting at this time, and one of the things they were discussing, do we give exemptions for those who are conscientious objectors? The Virginia militia had already given exemption, but now the draft had moved from Virginia to the Confederacy, so those who had exemption in Virginia now had to go through the Confederacy, and eventually the exemption said $500. Pay $500. Those who collected the money said it was a very easy collection to make. People were free to give and help. Those who were not exempt because they weren't church members, again, had to flee, go north, and by this time, church in the Shenandoah Valley was basically women, children, and old men when they had church, because conditions continued to deteriorate in the Shenandoah Valley. A story of one of the families that hid, Henry Brunk, protégé of all the Brunks in the Mennonite community. He hid in the community for a long time, and while he was there, his little two-year-old son died, and so son was buried in the Bank Church Cemetery, but his father could not come to the burial because scouts were there looking for him. So he hid in the bushes while his wife stood at the grave and buried their son. If you want to see their little grave, it's in the fourth row of the bank cemetery. But anyhow, and so then the father slipped away and eventually joined a group of people that went north and finally settled in Hagerstown, Maryland. He told his wife to come to meet him. In a war-torn valley, to use a term from a title of a book, his wife took her horse, her little other baby in her arms, and went driving down the valley. All kinds of soldiers. She was a feisty woman. Somebody tried to take her horse, and she said, you'll not do any such thing. She got to Harper's Ferry. The bridge was burned. What do you do? She took her horse and wagon and plunged into the river and made it across. And then where do you go? We talk about divine encounters where we meet someone. She was driving up the street in Hagerstown. Hagerstown was probably not as big as it is now. But she looked in a window of a cobbler shop, and there sat her husband. God brought them together. They lived in that area, then eventually moved west, and that's a different story. But, you know, God working in people's lives. Soldiers coming through, stealing. What do you do when people steal your things? I'd like to read from an account from The Burning by John L. Heatwell, talking about Samuel Kaufman. The Federals coming out of Harrisonburg being told that they were supposed to gather up all kinds of things and destroy all kinds of things. And so they came to the Kaufman farm. It's about half a mile west of Weaver's Church today. The bishop and his wife were sitting on the porch watching their younger children at play on the lawn, and the eldest son, John, age 16, was lying under a tree reading a book when a detachment of cavalry turned into their lane. Mrs. Kaufman rounded up the smallest children and took them inside. The bishop and his sons, John and Jacob, walked to the front gate. The soldiers bypassed the yard and drove directly to the barn and pasture field behind the house. Soon were heard the sharp crack of revolver and the carbine. As the pigs were killed in the barnyard, Kaufman saw a young heifer topple over in the pasture. John pleaded with his father to do something to stop the slaughter as he watched the sheep being gunned down, but his father shook his head and said something to the effect that the soldiers had obviously come on a mission, and the best that the family could do was pray for a little mercy. Jacob observed that if the killing continued, the family would have nothing left. The father responded gravely that that was his concern, too. What does the New Testament talk about, the spoiling of goods? This is Bishop Kaufman's experience. As the cavalrymen came toward the house, leading Judy and Prince, the family's best team of horses, the bishop remarked quietly, "At least they didn't shoot them." John, looking beyond, groaned audibly when he saw the soldiers also leading Nell, their best saddle horse. As the soldiers passed the yard gate, the bishop called out to them as he would to a neighbor, wishing the officer in charge a good day, and remarking to the lieutenant that he had a good team in their charge. The men stopped, and while stroking Judy's head, the lieutenant observed that the horses had obviously been well cared for. The bishop admonished the young man, "Just see that they still are." And when asked what the raid was about, the officer said that they had orders to leave nothing behind that would be of use to their enemies, and that was all that he knew about it. The bishop replied, "Or anything that might feed innocent women and children." The officer could think of no suitable answer and rode on, leading Judy, while one of his men followed on Nell and leading Prince. When the soldiers were gone, the bishop and his sons walked back to the barn and pasture to survey the damage. Dead animals were everywhere. A few pigs and sheep were nimble enough to escape. A couple of milk cows, a few chickens began to emerge from hiding places. Jacob remarked that the soldiers must have been out of bullets or they would have killed those few survivors too. What animals were left were driven to the safety of nearby molehill. And that was a good hiding place for animals. The bishop felt that he had a duty to his church members to stay but he discussed with his wife the possibility that he and the children should go north with the other refugee families. She would not consider it. They would all be right. They would be all right, she told her husband. And as far as food, you see them through the winter, God will take care of us. Their son John was at the age of military duty, and so he got a pass to go north. Tremendous suffering in the Shenandoah Valley during this time, particularly in 1864, when five counties were systematically burned and a large number of people went to Martinsburg, West Virginia, and then on to Maryland and Pennsylvania as refugees, including Katie Schenck. She was little, weighed 36 pounds or something like that, and she told her descendants, she had 15 of them, that she said, I walked the whole way to Pennsylvania, so I'll leave that be. So I said, the Laymans are a tough bunch. Okay. The family came back then, settled, but the whole area was burned and the people had to rebuild. The Civil War left a legacy of suffering, but also helping people to understand the suffering of others. And later on, when the Russian Mennonites left Russia because of loss of exemption for military services, Michael Schenck wrote in the church publication, "We need to help these people." He and his people had been in the Shenandoah Valley, had been through suffering, and the legacy that they have was of one of wanting to help others who are in need. One more legacy, and that is the legacy of missions. They wouldn't have called them missions in those days. Missions were something the Protestants did. But they went into the mountains and shared the gospel with people. They bypassed the foothills and eventually came back and started churches in places like the Peak and Bethany and places like that. But they had gone into the mountains, establishing little mini congregations, preaching in homes, preaching in brush arbors, preaching in schoolhouses. And so churches were established. And if you read the history, the number of churches, congregations in West Virginia was just amazing. A West Virginia communion service where 132 people participated. Traveling from place to place and preaching to hundreds of people, not all at the same time, but preaching. I was reading Lloyd Hurst's diary recently, and he wanted to go to Jasper Smith's funeral. Jasper Smith was a West Virginia man who had been ordained a preacher at the age of 91. He died, but the weather was too bad, so Lloyd couldn't go to his funeral. But there were ministers, deacons in West Virginia, and people going across the mountains to single ladies, many of them, helping visitation and so forth. A legacy of missions that developed. Preachers first going on horseback, preachers going on long extended visits, staying in homes, enjoying the local hospitality, enduring the hardships of living in the mountains, traveling through the mountains. Through the years, roads got better, so ministers continued. Usually it was ministers leaving on Friday evening, going until Sunday, and then coming home, and then picking up their work. And churches emerged. One place I read of 22 churches that emerged, and it's hard to know. Most of them have died out or merged with other congregations, but 22 churches emerged during this era. Mostly it was ministers by themselves, but there was one lady from Broadway who would go along with her husband. And Maddie Shank, for decades, she traveled with her bishop husband, assisting his work in visitation, counseling women, helping with communion. And one time she said, "I filled the buggy with bonnets and coverings and headed back into the mountains." And there were one person figured up. At one point, there were about 1,000 members in the Northern District of Virginia Conference, and about 500 of them were people who lived in the mountains. About a third of the ministers were also mountain people. Yes, they were culturally close because many of the people who lived in the mountains had been descendants of Hessian soldiers who stayed after the Revolutionary War, and the culture was very much the same. And I suspect that some of you in this congregation have some connections with some of those Hessians that moved back into West Virginia and stayed and joined the church. When Maddie Shank died in the early 20th century, it was one of the largest funerals because the people came out from the mountains. Hundreds came to pay their respects. Faithfulness of one woman. The youth took up the missions too. Summer Bible school and Sunday school. Those stories from the 1930s, 1940s, tremendous stories of young people. One young lady who just, well, she wasn't young, but she died in 2020. One summer, she spent 10 weeks straight teaching Bible school, two-week Bible schools in the mountains of West Virginia. And not only did they teach, but they visited in homes. She told about taking three young ladies with her to visit in a home. They shared a meal with the people. They didn't have much, but they shared. The one girl got a spoon, the one girl got a knife, and the one girl got a fork. And they had their meal. And I don't know what this lady ate with. They told the story. But they visited in homes. It wasn't just, you know, teach Bible school. Oh, good, now I can get back to work or something. But it was committing themselves. This young lady, some people would give her a tent or a trailer, and she would go into the community. And so for a whole summer, 10 weeks straight, she taught Bible school. That's beside the point, for not everybody did that. But so many people went into doing that in Bronx history that ends in 1960, he has maybe two pages of just lists of young people who taught Bible school. And churches emerged. And so we have in 1938, half of the people of their church district, maybe 500, were members in the Highlands. Oh, yes, and there's another little story who pays for all this? Who pays for this? There was a couple in Broadway that had a gas tank. They called it Gospel Gas. And if you stopped by their gas pump and signed their book, you could fill up with gas for your car to go teach Bible school or Sunday school. And that was a ministry. And they didn't just, drive in and drive out. They used their car for transportation. One lady who later became very active in developing summer Bible school, I've never seen the picture, but they have a picture of her with 20 children in her car, taking them to Bible school. Don't try that today. But the point is, they were serious about it. Through the years, things changed. Transportation became much easier. People in and out of the valleys. It's a legacy that goes clear back before the Civil War. And I wish we could get a vision again. I know times have changed. Things are different. But a vision, particularly of the young people, but others, committing themselves to communities, sharing the word, sharing the gospel. Three legacies that I wanted to share with you. One is the what might have been here in Luray, Strasbourg, Woodstock, that dinned. The legacy of Samuel Kaufman, which is interesting. I pulled out Life Songs and look at the beginning. The editor was S.F. Kaufman, one of the descendants of Samuel Kaufman, so you're still using that today. The story of faithfulness in the Civil War, because Samuel Kaufman made a choice to commit himself to non-resistance while his cousins in Greenbrier chose to become Confederate soldiers and support that. And he received a lot of flack from the community, threatening to be killed and so forth, but he was faithful in his office. Stories of people hiding, the Underground Railroad, people serving, helping, stories of prison, the 70 who were arrested in Petersburg. After the war, it was determined that the two scouts were illegal, and the U.S. government wanted the Mennonite and Dunker young men to press charges against them, and nobody would. Non-resistance carries through in many ways. Exemptions were given, and that's a blessing. Exemptions were given in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and even in the Confederacy. Exemptions were given, and the church body helped the people who did not have the money to pay their exemptions. Stories of faithfulness. And then that legacy of missions started way back before the Civil War with Samuel Kaufman, men and women faithfully sharing the gospel through the years. I challenge us to look. To continue our churches, we need strong leadership. We need a commitment to our faith. We need a commitment to standing by the faith from generation to generation to generation. I encourage you. God bless you. Stephen said, are you going to take time for questions? That's kind of scary because you're on the. Do you want it?
If you're willing, go
ahead. I can't promise anything, but any questions? Comments? There's some historians back there. I see one historian back there, sitting back there, Brother Burkholder. He might know more than I do on some of these things. Okay, he shook his head no. Okay. He was ordained to preach the gospel when he was 30 in 1852, and in 1861 he became bishop, so about 39. And it was, you know, uncharted territory, you know, because nobody had sat down and decided, okay, this is what we'll do in case of war. And they weren't always united. There's Augusta County people down at that Hildebrand Church. They were a mess. When Jefferson Davis called for a day of prayer and fasting, they said, yes, let's do it. And Samuel Kaufman said, no, we don't have anything to pray and fast about. And so, you know, we kind of presented as kind of a real clean, crisp story. And sometimes it was a little murky. The sad thing in the Hildebrand Mennonite Cemetery, there's about 10 graves of people, either church members or sons of church members, who were killed in the Civil War on the Confederate side. And it's not the story we tell, but everybody wasn't as faithful as they should have been. Okay, any other? Yes.
In the Baptist Church Cemetery, there's a headstone that says Captain Abraham Huff, Company F, Virginia Military, Confederate States of America, died in 1864. Do you know the story behind that?
Do you know it, Midge? They put up that... I don't know if he died as he was traveling through or what. They did put up a monument, and Bank congregation did ask that they not have a memorial service on Sunday morning when they put it up. But that cemetery was a community cemetery. There are Confederates, there are Mennonites, there are blacks, all kind of people buried in there. When the lawnmower came, then we started putting things in nice rows. Before, it was a family plot here and a family plot here and a family plot here. And that's why Henry Brunk could hide in the bushes and watch his son being buried, because it was just family plots. And then when the lawnmower came, you start putting everything in lines. So who knows who's buried where? It has caused problems already. One brother, when he went, wanted to be buried here, and they started burying in. Somebody else had a video and it was already there. Okay, yeah. So I've heard the story, but I'm not sure the details on that. But he's a big monument there in the corner. Back in the corner where some of the former slaves were buried. And incidentally, it's a good possibility that the Bank Church had black members before the Civil War. That people who joined the church had to turn their slaves free. And the slaves thought that was a pretty good idea. And Black Jack was one who sat back by the door in the corner. He, I guess he knew his place. But that was. I have a map that of the church and has an X, and it said that's where Black Jack sat. And whether he was a member or not, they didn't keep very good records back in those days. But good possibility there were black members at Bank Church before the Civil War. Okay. Yes.
Your comments there about Kate Layman, you know, that my great grandmother.
Okay.
And seems like it should be longer ago than that. My great grandmother. Then her husband Martin Layman, who gave the Church of Sunday School handle, and one of the men that was involved in the Church of Sunday School.
Okay. So the legacy continues, unless we all kick out all the old songbooks and get Hymns of the Church, you know. That's the end thing right now. And I like that songbook. I really do. But let's be careful about all the old songs are kind of disappearing if we're not careful. And so, yes, part of the legacy. I'll just wrap up there. Your first song tonight, To God Be the Glory. That was Scott Showalter's, one of his favorite songs. And today, 16 years ago, he and his family perished in the manure pit there at... Yes.
The fence snakes that settled Middletown when it was called Sessingville, were they Mennonites?
I don't know.
I had a friend who was a historian ask me that question, and I didn't know either.
There's a lot of names that could have been Mennonites or not. You know, a lot of people lost their identity through just there was nobody for their children to marry, and so they just kind of assimilated into the larger. I didn't know that. That's, you say that was Middletown.
Middletown, Virginia.
Okay.
Maryland, Virginia.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Anything else? I'll turn it back over to Steve, and because historians tend to go on, and I want to stop here at a decent time. Okay. God bless you, and continue the legacy of faith. Yeah, continue it. Pass it on to the next generation and let them know the stories. Let them know the stories. Somebody said, why don't you write a book? I said, they're already written down. You just have to find them. Okay. God bless you.